Welcome to our final session. Before we turn to the panel, I just need to tell you a few things. So even though this is going to be our last part of the main conference, as you know, there are satellite workshops that will be starting right this afternoon. So join whichever one you prefer. Now we have a panel that will go from 10:30 to noon. Unfortunately, one of our panelists will have to run out. At 11:30, but please stay with us till noon and just make sure you ask any questions you have been dreaming to ask. So now we're going to turn into the panel, who's going to be moderated by Ian O'Neill from Discovery News. Ian?
Thank you. Yes, I'm Ian O'Neill, space producer for Discovery News, and I have a history of physics. I used to be in solar physics, theoretical solar physics. So I'm very envious of a lot of you guys who are able to speak at this wonderful conference. And I wanted to thank the organizers of Perimeter for the convergence, because this is an amazing collection of minds. And I'm honored to be here, and I'm honored to be hosting this panel of very distinguished scientists. And it's quite a range we've got here. We've got everybody from quantum optics to gravitational waves, particle physics, and exoplanets. So it's going to be less about me asking the questions, and I'm going to be turning to you guys quite a lot, because I think this conference has really shown that, as was said on the first day of the conference, there's a stunning simplicity in theoretical physics. Everything seems to be converging towards these similar ideas. And there's a lot of crossovers between different disciplines, and I'm very eager to see how our panel reacts to your questions. And also, I'd love to know your views. I would love to get your reactions to the last few days of really cool lectures that we've had. And if you've got any opinions you want to share with us, and perhaps our panelists can question you, as we've got a lot of time, as we'll be going up to noon, we'll be able to have a lot of time for those questions. So I just wanted to quickly introduce our panelists and where they're from, and then I'll hand over to them with a couple of questions, and then we'll open up the floor for questions. So we'll start far end first. We've got Patrick R. Brady. He's into gravitational waves, and he's from the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. Next, we've got Stefania Gori, and she's into particle physics, so I'm looking forward to asking her some questions about the LHC and Higgs boson in particular. And she's at the Perimeter Institute, so she's here from here. We've also got Emmanuel Bloch, and unfortunately we're going to be losing Emmanuel in about an hour, but I'll be sure to get some questions in first. And he's into quantum optics, so I suppose he's a quantum optician. I suppose that would be quite accurate. I hope it's accurate anyway. And he's from the Max Planck Institute and University of Munich. And of course, we've got Sarah Seeger, exoplanets, did a great talk yesterday. So I'm looking forward to some questions about aliens, just a hint. And she's from MIT. So in the vein of this conference, really is very forward-looking. And I would love to know from our panelists what their hopes and their fears are and their challenges in their particular fields of expertise and what they hope for the future, really. I just kind of want to get a general gist of what they do on their day-to-day and what they see happening in the future. So I'd like to start far end, so with Patrick first. Gravitational waves. They've been in the news quite a lot, obviously, with cosmological gravitational waves from the beginning of time. And of course, we've got LIGO and other gravitational wave detectors doing amazing stuff. We're on the verge of gravitational astronomy. How do you fit into this? And how do you even approach this amazing field of discovery?
Well, I'm part of the LIGO collaboration, which is a fairly big organization, about 1,000 people these days. And I focus mostly on the analysis of the data. So preparing for that task. The state of the field is actually very exciting now. You heard Nurgis talk the other day, and she described to us just how good the detectors are and showed us the sensitivity curves. We're able to measure these changes of distance at about 10 to the minus 18 meters. It's just incredible in terms of the instrumental side of the subject. But the really exciting thing for me is we are just ready now to start taking the data with those new instruments. And what I like to make a comparison of is the comparison with the generation of detectors that existed and came to an end with their data taking in 2010 to the detectors as they exist essentially today. And it turns out, in terms of our survey volume of the universe, if we get a week of data with the sensitivity today, that's equivalent to the several years of data that we took with those earlier instruments. And so we really are on the edge of an exciting era in gravitational wave astronomy, and one that hopefully will bring that first measurement of gravitational waves directly, where we see the effect of the wave as it passes by us on the Earth, rather than seeing the indirect impact on another system. Right. So,
very exciting. I can't wait to see the first gravitational wave map of the universe. I wonder what that'll look like.
Well, that might be a while coming, although, you know, we never know. But I think actually the thing which we're excited about is this idea that neutron stars and black holes that go around each other and come together over a period of time, over many millions of years, and eventually crash into each other, mm-hmm. will generate gravitational waves in the frequency range for the Earth-based detectors.
Right.
Now, I should, you know, there's a lot of excitement, and we can talk more about it as it goes on, but there's a lot of exciting things that we can do beyond the first direct observation of them, and that's when we get into gravitational wave astronomy, where hopefully we can learn about neutron star equation of state, hopefully we can measure some of the parameters of the expansion of the universe, perhaps we can even detect the signatures for axions or something like that due right. to their effects around black holes. So mm-hmm. I think that the sort of, we just don't know what we're going to see, actually, is really the cool part of it.
And this is the thing I found with this conference is that I've never come across so many people that are so excited by not knowing something. I mean, if this was any other industry, I think we'd all be out of jobs because nobody knows what's going on. But we've got some really good idea of which direction it's going, and gravitational waves are one of those fields that I know the readers at Discovery News love anything to do with gravitational waves, and just the possibilities are phenomenal. So I want to go to Stefania. I want to know a little bit about what you work on. I know you work on some data with the LHC, and I just want to know some of your hopes and your challenges and your hopes for the future, really, in your field.
Yeah, thank you very much, Ian. So I think it's a particular time for particle physics, because now that we have the Higgs boson, so we have this completely brand new particle that we have discovered basically 3 years ago.
Yeah.
It's even newer, if you want, because the LHC, as we know, had some period of shutdown. So it's kind of a brand new particle.
Mm-hmm.
And for the very, very first time, now we know something about the mechanism for giving mass to the elementary particles, so the standard model. So in my opinion, this has been really a great achievement for physics and for particle physics. So of course, the question is now, what next, right? So there are very many big open questions in particle physics. I think dark matter is the question for particle physics in the coming years. And of course, we have, so from the, if you want, from more the experimental point of view, we have the question of what dark matter is and how to find it. We have really a plethora of experiments that are looking for dark matter and a lot of opportunities for finding dark matter in the coming years. At the same time, I think there are challenges in really defining our guiding principles, if you want, because now that we have the Higgs, we cannot really escape anymore from what we call the hierarchy problem, so this problem of naturalness, because we know the mass of the Higgs, we know that the mass of the Higgs is pretty light, much, much lighter than the Planck scale, so the hierarchy problem is there, right? And we know also that this hierarchy problem, and in general the problem of naturalness, has been really a guiding principle for particle physics since decades. At the same time, there are experiments like the LHC that are pushing this idea of naturalness because of the LHC null results up to now. So the question if, to ask is indeed if nationalism is the good guiding principles, how nationalism can be realized, so what type of theories we can write down that are natural, and at the same time, they are in agreement with our experiments. So I think this is pretty much a theoretical challenge. And in my opinion, what is also quite challenging, if you look more in the far future, is to understand really what new experiments we can build, and what physics case we have for these new experiments. So we have heard a lot in this workshop about you know, having new higher energy machines, new colliders, but also new smaller scale experiments. And I think for the you know, the wealth of our field, we really should have both of these routes that are going in parallel, hand by hand. So having you know, larger experiments, a larger LHC, and also smaller scale experiments. Of course, if you think about having a larger LHC, the question is, and the challenge is a technological and engineering challenge. So I think for all these you know, challenges and open questions that we have in particle physics, is, it is a really, really exciting field.
It is. And I think, I just think only a couple of years ago, we didn't even know the Higgs existed.
Correct.
But probably one thing, you mentioned it, it's a really exciting time for theoretical physics in the area of particle physics. Say if there was a signal that we got out of the LHC that we didn't predict. I mean, is that, does that excite you, or does that kind of scare you that, wow, there's a hole in our understanding. We don't know what this particle is. We don't know what the signal is.
Yeah.
It's a new particle. It's a new force, but we don't know what it is.
Yeah. I mean, from my point of view, that would be the most exciting you know, result that we could have from the LHC. A totally unexpected you know, signal that we really don't know how to explain theoretically. That would be really exciting because that would put us in a position on, of asking more and more questions and trying to understand what this signal is, what the new particles is predicting, this new signal, and what we can learn more for fundamental physics. So I think what you mentioned is you know, the optimistic result that we could have in the next coming years, definitely.
Oh, yeah. Very exciting, very exciting. So now we go, we keep them the very small. And one thing that's impressed me a lot about this conference, because I've got very little understanding with quantum physics, and I remember being an undergrad and I had my first quantum physics class and I was just, my mind was blown. And when I saw your presentation about quantum optics, I was like, whoa, we can do that with particles? We can actually manipulate single atoms to create these amazing intricate patterns. I mean, I was amazed. So where do you, Emmanuel, where do you see your field going? Because it seems to you've had some very big advances in a very short space of time. And you're able to carry out some really complex stuff inside the lab, not using like the LHC-sized instrumentation, but using almost like tabletop experiments, as you showed us in your presentation. Where do you see it going from here? I mean, and how, what kind of challenges are you facing now? Is it purely technological, or is it like theoretical understanding you need to improve on?
Well, I think it's both, really. And I think in a sense, we're in a remarkable time in terms of quantum many-body systems, where we see a convergence of a lot of ideas coming from quantum information science, many-body physics, condensed matter physics, quantum optics coming together and really helping us to understand many-body systems in a new way. And what excites me in that these are not only theoretical concepts that we use to describe and characterize these systems, but now I think we also have the possibilities to really detect these kind of concepts in the lab, to implement them in the lab. So I think it gives us a really new perspective on understanding quantum matter, understanding quantum materials, and looking in detail what's going on there. And that's, of course, something that's driving my research forward, to, you know, look, try to, on the one hand, realize new quantum materials, realize new quantum systems with new effects on the one hand, and on the other hand, kind of using new techniques to observe these systems atom by atom, current by current, that's flowing in these systems with high resolution. And that's really opened a whole new window, I think. And so it's really bringing together a lot of researchers from different fields and in exciting time. And so of course, we hope to, you know, also discover maybe something new, a new phase of matter that would be very exciting, right. Or just, you know, understand better how matter behaves, understand how matter in non-equilibrium situations behaves, and maybe extend this even if we think of Subir's talk that we've been telling about, you know, maybe there are microscopic models, condensed matter models, which are even have connections to, let's say, gravity. Yeah, so right. We can maybe simulate gravity with that. So I don't know, we'll see, but that's certainly an exciting time to be in.
That's awesome, because I love the crossover as well, from like gravitational waves to the quantum world as well. So you've got the LIGO, which is now detecting the finest scales possible, so it's getting interfered with by quantum variations in the laser itself. Are you thinking that your technology can improve on the models? So basically you're looking on the very small, and your technology could be used to help in the search for something very, very big. Do you see any obvious crossovers there?
Okay, so our research is, of course, more, you know, interested in these many body systems, but it's sure. conceivable, I think, in some point that, you know, people like my colleague Junier in Boulder, who are building these very precise atomic clocks, right. I mean, they're certainly thinking about using kind of correlated quantum states to improve on those clocks, so to even make them better than they are today. And, you know, those clocks for sure, at some point, you know, they're going to improve our navigational possibilities, and they might be the ones that at some point steer our spacecraft through space and place the satellites of some advanced LIGO-LISA experiment in space, which is a big problem. And so I think it's really, in a sense, convergence of technologies also there. But I see myself, my research, more at the fundamental side of, you know, finding out about those many body systems and identifying what they do, but it's absolutely conceivable that they will also have impact on technological aspects and to other fields in science, as they've already had.
Wonderful. So now we're going, again, from the small to quite far away. Sarah, your research is into exoplanets and looking for habitable exoplanets. Of course, never out of the news headlines, always talking about exoplanets, especially in recent years, what with the Kepler telescope. And now we're looking for the holy grail, really, of exoplanets. We're looking for an Earth-like planet. Of course, Earth-like kind of carries a lot of responsibility, because how do we find a planet that actually resembles ours that can support life? So what would you say is the main challenges for you? And, you know, what do you see in the future of exoplanets? Because it seems to have, everything's happened so quickly. In my short career in science communication, we've gone from, like, the discovery of the first exoplanet to knowing there's thousands of them out there. Not only thousands of big planets, but also very, very small rocky worlds. Where do you see it going from here?
Well, right now, we actually know what our future is, provided we can actually build the space telescopes and some ground-based facilities and make them stable enough to make the observations we want. Now that we know there are thousands of planets and that small planets are common, we just need to look at more and more stars in better and better detail, and we want to be able to suppress the starlight and to see planets directly. So this is a problem, actually, because our telescope, we can imagine, we want we're greedy, actually. Maybe that applies to all of us here, but it's not just enough to find one that might be like Earth. We'd like to have dozens and dozens of small planets, terrestrial planets, that we can see if we don't reach a dead end from spectra, that we can identify as Earth-like and even have a chance to look for signs of life. But to be able to find dozens of planets, we need to look at hundreds of stars or even more. And we figure, actually, we may need like a 10-meter class space telescope to do so. We actually have a concept. I won't go into too much detail here, but it's called, we call it HDST, High Definition Space Telescope, because in addition to finding exoplanets, if we want to have something, a UV optical infrared telescope that all of astronomy could use, did you know you would be able to see all distances in the universe to 100 parsecs? The universe gets smaller in the past, but nonetheless, let's say that we have our future ahead of us and all the current planned and being built telescopes on the ground and in space get launched, and they have a shot at finding one or two Earths, and we get to build this much bigger telescope in space and look at hundreds of stars, we have a great shot at finding something. And a lot of that is just pure speculation, because sure. we have no idea how common life is. So that's why I'm so optimistic, because myself and all of us here and all the other people, you know, working in related fields can witness or be a part of this whole search for another Earth. But what happens then? What happens if this, you know, we go in the next 30 years, because space telescopes are often 30 years from concept to launch, and we look at all those hundreds of stars and we find maybe dozens or even 100 Earths and don't see signs of life. 100's not that many when you think about that. Then what's next? And that's where I would worry, but it'll be past my timeline, so I just try to inspire my students and maybe it's the people being born today, what are they going to do? Because in astronomy, it seems like we may be reaching the end of our paradigm of building big things. We have the big, large ground-based telescopes of the future, but can they keep building? I mean, they're just making more and more segments, but eventually that won't work. In space, you know, 10 to 20 meter telescope, we have to fold it up into the fairing and then unfold. We will have to do something totally new. Maybe we haven't. Maybe it's something we've thought of, like assembly in space. Maybe it's something else, like printing and constructing in space. So that thing is like ahead of us. We know what to do. If we can do it, we're going to do our best to make it happen. But it's sort of that next step. If we don't find what we're looking for, we have to keep going. And I think that's one thing that is common to many here, despite working on such disparate fields. If you don't find what you want, what's the next thing? Not only can you afford it or not, but can you actually conceive of how to build it?
Right. So I suppose the next big mission coming out, the next big space telescope, of course, is the James Webb Space Telescope. And it's being launched in 2018, I think, the last estimate. How do you see that affecting your studies? I mean, is that going to really help with looking
for these habitats? Well, James Webb will revolutionize exoplanet atmospheres. Wow. We have Hubble now that we've been using and studied maybe a dozen exoplanet atmospheres in detail. And James Webb will help yet again. But, you know, it's... this is the part where we sound greedy, right? Because the James Webb wasn't built for exoplanets. And we will have some transiting small planets with rocky planets with these thin atmospheres. Remember how I talked about the atmospheres were compressed if it's high molecular weight? Mm-hmm. And we'll be hard-pressed to study terrestrial-like planet atmospheres, actually. We might get really lucky. You know, maybe there's a transiting planet around a very near small star, and everything's in our favor, and we're able to see it. And if life was ubiquitous, we actually could have some shot at finding a sign of life with the James Webb. But we don't want to overpromise. And in fact, we worked this out in a so-called revised Drake equation. You can set the first few terms of how common Earths are around these small stars that James Webb will have access to. How likely is it that a planet will transit? And you know, we actually can work all of that out. We just don't know how common life is, or if all life generates a spectroscopic signature we can detect. So the James Webb, you know, in exoplanets, nature has delivered over and over again. Anytime we look, we see a planet in that range of parameter space. So we have to be optimistic, but the chance of James Webb really helping us find and identify an Earth that would be transiting a small star, it's somewhat low.
Yeah. It's very exciting. This is one thing I find with exoplanetary studies, there's always surprises. Always, always surprises. So I'm very excited for all your fields. Now, I kind of want to open up quite quickly into audience questions. And if you can think about more quantum optics side for Emmanuel first, because he has to leave at 11:30. So I want to start this conversation really, and it can be a two-way thing. So if you've got any ideas yourself that you want to share with our panelists so they can respond, or they can even ask questions of you. Of course, panelists can ask each other's questions. I just want this to be an open floor, an open forum, as this is the final panel, so that you don't get these opportunities very often to have such great scientists here, ready to answer your questions or participate in your discussion. So, any questions to kick things off?
Cool. For Emmanuel Bloch, first of all, I was absolutely spellbound by your talk. I'd like to make two comments and then ask you to answer a question. I would say you could make all these fabulous experiments thanks to two incredible gifts of nature. One is that we live in a universe which is very far from equilibrium, and secondly, that universe creates a local inertial frame of reference. Those two things, that's the sort of the Machian idea. So I wonder to what extent we may be distorting our understanding of what the universe really works because of these two gifts of nature that enable you to make these fantastic experiments. And I just would like to draw a comparison with Ptolemy. Ptolemy's work on the planets was far better than anybody realizes, and he had wonderful descriptions of each individual planet separately. But he could not in any way relate the ones to the other. And the great insight of Copernicus was to realize that there was an overall view, a comprehensive synoptic view of the whole lot. And there's this fabulous passage where he says Ptolemaic astronomy was like someone who'd taken the limbs and the head from different animals. Each of the limbs and the head and so forth were depicted very wonderfully, but what resulted was a monster. And of course, what Copernicus produced was an incredibly beautiful picture. He knew exactly where the planets were, how fast they were going, and so forth like that. Have you any idea how this incredible work you're doing now could lead to the Copernican unification of that Ptolemaic systems of the individual planets? Oh, let me just add one last thing. When he died, he was able to predict hundreds of years ahead of his time what the sky would look like from Alexandria. But Ptolemy had not the remotest idea what the sky would look like from Mars. And that wasn't actually confirmed until the Voyager spacecraft went to Mars. Mm. Of course, everybody believed in it before then, but that was, I think that's a thing to think about.
Well, I would try to stay modest in you know, what we can do and who to compare to. But I mean, certainly, I mean, what you're saying, what is exciting that we do find physics happening at the highest energy scales, we're probing at LHC, you know, and we find similar things, not exactly the same thing, but it's related behavior of this relativistic quantum field theory sometimes at the lowest energy scales where we are probing. And certainly when we look at non-equilibrium dynamics, you know, it would be fantastic to look at some of the non-equilibrium effects of many-body quantum systems and then learn something for maybe for the expansion of the universe from that. I don't know, you know, we have to see sometimes, of course, when people make connections between those two and try to make, there are limits to that, I think, in some regions, but there also can be, you know, potential insight into how these systems behave. And the nice thing, of course, we have in the lab, you know, the big difference from an observational being an observational experimentalist, what we can do in the lab is, of course, we can always change the initial conditions. We can change something, we can look, what's the dynamics now? What's the system doing now? I mean, we're not constrained to being just the observer, but we can really look how different initial conditions affect, let's say, for example, a quantum dynamics. And that's certainly something interesting to look at. I'm not sure that that answers your question. That's what you're alluding to, but
just a very quick one coming yes. back. I want to say actually what the wonderful stuff they do at the LHC is actually, from my point of view, just looking at Jupiter rather than Mercury.
Okay.
I mean, it relies upon the same fact that the universe is out of equilibrium and they've got an inertial frame of reference. I mean, at the LHC, yeah. they can tell when there's a storm breaking on the Atlantic coast of France, so they have to take that into account. So they again rely on the local inertial frame of reference and the non-equilibrium state of the universe. Cool.
There's another question.
Yes. I wonder how difficult it is to cool a giant molecule of a Planck mass scale, which is about 10 to the minus 5 gram. You know, if one can achieve that, that might be a system one can probe some kind of quantum gravity effect. But I wonder how large is the experimental challenge to cool such a giant molecule?
To cool such a giant molecule? Well, the problem is, of course, you know, the reason why this cooling, at least the laser cooling and all our evaporation was so successful with atoms was because they have very few resonance lines. So they are very well isolated actually from the environment because they exchange energy with the thermal surrounding very ineffectively because there's just very few absorption emission processes going on because of the very few lines in the atom. Now, if you already go to molecules, things change dramatically. Okay, diatomic is still kind of, okay, that's almost as an atom, yeah. But if you go to more complex molecules, they have all these rotational, vibrational degrees of freedom. And of course, that means they couple much stronger, much more efficiently to the radiation environment. And you have to work much harder to shield them, to cool them from that. So for sure, you need cryogenic environments to do that, to shield the atoms, to make them cold and you know, we don't know. Just and then also there are bad reaction channels when two molecules collide. They usually like to react. There's just so much phase space. What can happen? And it usually happens, yeah? And that also doesn't help very much. So I think we have to see. I mean, there are efforts going on by many, many people in the field trying to cool larger molecules directly and making them cold quantum gases, cold molecular gases out of them. And we'll have to see where those efforts lead. But certainly a big challenge, very difficult.
Yeah. Blue shirt.
Another question for Emmanuel. You mentioned technology. Could you give us a few examples of technology based on quantum matter, for example, quantum metrology?
Well, I was giving this example of the clocks, right? I mean, the clocks have been you know, driving, I think, I mean, throughout history, I mean, clocks have been the thing that's been most amazing to mankind. I mean, they've been revolutionizing navigation all over again and again. And now we have these fantastic clocks based on optical lattices, called atoms and optical lattices, you know, that are probably going to, you know, be the next time standard that people are going to converge on. But then we're going to go a step beyond that. We're going to try to make even better clocks, for example, by using correlated quantum states to improve the precision of how we can read out those clocks. So people are thinking about these ideas of doing that. And certainly we're also thinking about, you know, how can you, you know, engineer correlations into many body systems that you can make them useful for your specific measurement problem. I mean, that might be a clock, that might be magnetic fields, electrical field measurements, and people are certainly thinking about that. So there's this whole field of quantum technologies out there. There's a whole exciting field of atom interferometry out there, if you think of experiments in Mark Kasowitz's group in Stanford, where they're building, you know, atom interferometers, which, you know, sense rotation, can sense also even, you know, if you put a brick, a lead brick close to the interferometer, it can sense the change of the gravitational field due to that lead brick. Yeah? So there's really amazing technological advancements that I think mostly come in, on the one hand, in navigation aspects, but also maybe then at some point in computational aspects. You know, if we really are able to build a universal quantum computer, it's not what our systems are suitable for, I think, but other people are working on this, then they're going to find a lot of impact, you know, in probably mostly in physics, actually, I think.
Yeah, you mentioned quantum computing. Just open this up to everybody, really, on the panel. How do you think quantum computers would eventually be used? Because I almost think this quantum computers are going to be an application which doesn't really have a problem to fix, because at the moment we can't even conceive a lot of the calculations that this machine, that, well, I imagine this box with a quantum computer in it, what it will actually do. Do you have any idea how that such a vastly advanced form of computing may transform your fields? I mean, and what problem would you get it to work on? I mean,
well, I mean, it really, I think it comes down to Feynman's original vision, and I think the physics problems are exactly the ones where we're going to most need them. Maybe in chemistry, although we lack, what big problem is somehow we lack kind of knowledge of efficient codes, how to implement that. We don't know that we can get this quantum speed up, you know, this quantum parallelism speed up that people often cite. We only know a few problems where we can get that, and a few algorithms so we can really exploit that. But actually physics problems, and actually if we look at dynamics and, you know, a lot of these problems of physical systems, material systems, they are certainly problems that could definitely benefit from such a system. So right. It's not going to be your text processor, it's not going to run any faster, your Word or something, for sure. No, that's not going to be the application. But I think certainly in physics, as Feynman originally envisaged, and maybe also in chemistry, if we find the right codes, we could see those have dramatic improvements.
Because Sarah, is the computation of exoplanetary atmospheres and statistics behind exoplanets, I mean, is that a limitation with the computational technology we got today, or is it just that it's more of a data-driven science, and it's just really you just need to find different ways of digesting that?
Well, just address this question briefly, and I'll move on there.
Sure.
We talked about this last night, actually, and whether that all problems in quantum mechanics for molecules could actually be in the future solved. And it's what Emmanuel said, that until the algorithms make it faster, we can't do it. But we have a lot of problems that are of peripheral interest to me, like stability of molecules. And my colleagues will say, look, it'll take 2 years. We have to set up the problem and run it on a supercomputer. So maybe in the future, there's a hope for those molecules to be done on the quantum computer. Okay. In terms of exoplanets and data, like, believe it or not, probably the hardest problems right now are in planet formation. How do you go from a disk of gas and dust that has some instabilities or some anomalies into planets? And there are many phases of that which aren't understood. And although computers are a problem, the main limiting factor is probably understanding some of the physical processes or not knowing which ones that have to be put into the giant simulation. Right. So we do have a data problem, but it's much more conventional.
Yeah. And like the LHC, of course. Lots of data.
Exactly. Yeah, it's really a matter of data processing.
Right.
But as we know, actually, so the LHC cannot really get all data, so all proton-proton collisions that you are having, you cannot really record. So we have what is called triggers that are telling us that basically you have to to have some specific collision that you can record and then later analyze. Right, because I mean, it's really a big problem of data acquisition and data processing. So that is probably the main, you know, challenge from the LHC point of view.
And one of the spin-offs I love about the LHC is the fact the internet was kind of spawned from
Correct.
Data processing and data transmission from the LHC and, well, from CERN. And I love the comment the other day that the LHC would have broken the internet. So
right, right.
I was very satisfied to see that.
Yeah.
Was there any questions along this, along these veins?
So this was regard to the search for exoplanets. And so you spoke a lot about what happens if we don't find what we're looking for. I was wondering what happens if we do find what we're looking for, and what's the next?
Well, we're so busy figuring out how to find things, we actually often don't think about that, actually, what to do next. Now, one thing that happens in exoplanets is it's really captured well by a journalist who was blogging back when blogs were just becoming popular, and his blog once said, discovery of an Earth-like planet, again and again and again. Because often people will make a claim, and this is very happens quite often in exoplanets, and it's just totally either overblown or it's just not good. I'll give you like a minor example before coming back to this. One of my colleagues and I conceived of so-called carbon planets. And that is, if you could imagine a planetary system like a nebula forming that was richer in carbon to oxygen than our solar system is, then instead of the oxygen going with silicon to make rocks, oxygen could go with carbon. Like carbon would sort of suck up the oxygen. You could imagine in this planet. Actually, we know about this from red stars, from the big red giant stars. They have remember before how I said in exoplanets we're just applying things, old ideas in a new way? There are these AGB stars that they are carbon-rich in their outer shells, and so they have all this carbon-rich chemistry going on. If your carbon-to-oxygen ratio is close to 1 or greater than 1, unlike in our solar system, where it's more like 0.5, then different chemistry happens. So your planet would just capture a huge amount of carbon, and you could even imagine if you had the right part of the phase diagram that you would have a small diamond layer. Well, what happened was then more and more papers came out talking about this, these carbon-rich planets. The whole thing got completely overblown. And then in the news, there's reported, oh, a diamond, pure diamond planet has been found.
I'm really sorry.
If you look at the carbon, was that your fault? I'm like, really? No, he's joking. All you have to do is Google the carbon phase diagram, and you'll see there's just a small teensy range of temperature pressure space where even if you had pure carbon, you know, you could actually get the diamond phase. So FYI.
So technically.
Anyway, back to the life problem. Back to the life. I just use that as an example because it was when that was, but I don't know. At first, I think we'll just start to see claims. Oh, we found life here, we found life there. But if you dig a little bit deeper, no, actually. People will have seen something and maybe it's sort of at the edge of detectability. Maybe they will have just sort of barely found an unusual molecule. And so we'll sort of have to take a long time, I think, before we really do can establish that there is life beyond Earth. In fact, many of the gases have false positives.
Sure, yeah.
And so some will say, we found this, and then later on other people will make like a counterclaim. And so I think it will be a while before we establish, maybe we'll have to find many examples. That's why I started out with the dozens of Earths or hundreds of them and find many examples of what looks like that there's unusual gases and collectively establish it. So maybe that was just a long way of sort of saying, I'm not really sure what we'll do next. I mean, I think a lot of things would happen. The first thing, of course, we'd want to build the next space telescope and get a better look at other gases. I think the future would think of some ginormous interferometers in space to actually now spatially resolve the planet, maybe get like 10 pixels on the planet. And it may not be like the topic for here today, but I think people are going to want to find out how to send a probe there. It would take a long, long time to get to another planetary system, another star system, and look more closely. So I think it will really just motivate like a whole new set of things to go on.
Yeah, it's funny because you just touched on that, sending a probe to another star. And I work quite closely with Icarus and Stellar. There's a bunch of engineers and physicists who are really thinking beyond the next 50 years, 100 years, and actually talking about the technology behind sending a probe to another star, an unmanned probe. And their vision for the future is that they will start getting attention once we discover that exoplanet with a breathable atmosphere, or we would consider to be a true Earth-like planet. So these guys are really looking hard at exoplanetary studies and saying, okay, that could change society. When we actually find that gem out there in the galaxy, it could change society and it could make us all look upward and want some means of getting there, and they want to provide that transportation. But But yeah, no, it's an exciting field. No, we've got to be very careful about mentioning Earth-like, and I've actually started pulling that name from headlines because it gives the wrong impression we have actually discovered Earth.
Right.
But for a long time, we'd use it over and over again and say every single claim that came out, it was always Earth-like. And it's like, well, how Earth-like is this world compared to the last one? And actually, there's no indication to suggest it's Earth-like at all. It just has the correct orbit. And that is, yeah, Earth size and correct orbit, and that's all we really know. But I love the starshade concept as well. That's very exciting. I want to see that in space very soon. Any questions? Yeah, just up here.
So this is kind of a question for everyone, but maybe start with Stefania. So in astrophysics, we talk a lot about legacy science. So like one of the big things with the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, it was built for galaxies, but had a lot of legacy science, I think, for exoplanets and such. And you know, we've talked about like big new experiments. But what can we do if we don't get the big experiments with what we have, you know, on tape already, so to speak? So if we don't get LISA, if we don't get 100 TeV collider, if we don't get the Starshade, how much can we do with going back to data that we already have? I mean, maybe they sound like smaller questions or something, but you know, they can be just as interesting. What can we do with what we've got if we just reprocess our data? Is it accessible, et cetera? Maybe start with Stefania and everyone could come in.
Yeah, I think so the best that could happen for particle physics in the future is, as I said, to have really smaller scale experiments as well as larger and larger experiments that are going in parallel. So what I'm saying is that optimistically in the future, indeed, we'll have larger scale experiments, so going to higher energy, there will be funds for this. And this is really the most optimistic you know, future that we can envision for particle physics. As you mentioned, there is the opportunity, there is the possibility that larger LHC won't get funded. In that case, I think there will be more and more an important effort on searching for smaller scale experiments and how to look for you know, new particles, new interactions, using, indeed, experiments that are smaller, so smaller energies, but nevertheless very important because, as we have discussed quite a bit during this workshop, smaller scale experiments could you know, discover the axion, could discover new new symmetries of nature, so a new gauge boson that is pretty light. So in my opinion, there are really plenty of opportunities of using smaller scale experiments in our field for looking for new interactions and new particles. Of course, if you want to, if your question, if the you know the main question that is leading your research is to look for you know heavier and heavier particle, then you need really to go to high energy. So somehow you need to have these large experiments that are pushing our reach for heavy particles. Does it answer to your question?
Patrick, so along that, because I know that you're trying to boost sensitivity of LIGO, I mean, is there anything in data that you've collected so far that could indicate the existence of gravitational waves, or is it you're in a process of elimination right now?
Well, yeah, we've processed all the data we've taken so far with our best ideas for how to do the analysis and what to look for, and we've got no plausible signals. So that's where we stand today. But I think the question's interesting when you take it starting from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, which is often quoted as this example of a very rich data set that is only partially explored even now. Mm-hmm. With LIGO and gravitational wave astronomy, we're hoping that all of our data will eventually be released to the public. It's actually a modest set of data when you focus on the one thing that we can hear, which is the strain caused by the gravitational waves. So I think the opportunity for that data set, those data sets to be mined by others in the future when we get new ideas, when we understand better how to simulate perhaps certain sources because we can't quite get them right now with our computing or with our knowledge of the physics, and we can get them better later. I think that's going to be something that will happen. The in terms of Lisa was mentioned in the question, and I think this is the one of the challenges for gravitational wave astronomy right now, is that we don't know really very much. The window will be opened in the next 5 years, we hope. It'll be our first opportunity to directly explore the dynamical gravity in this sort of unique way to see what happened. But we're in such a very narrow frequency range in some sense. We're going from 10 hertz to a kilohertz. That's where the ground-based detectors can see things. I think the fact that we have other data sets coming online, like the pulsar timing arrays that are going to look at nanohertz gravitational waves, that's a very interesting, very intriguing field and possibility. But I think in the end, we're stuck with the same problem. We need to make sure that we do as well as we can with the instruments we build today.
Sure.
Find those corners where there's these questions that are just still confusing us, and hopefully stay in a state of confusion for plenty of time, and then convince people that we should build the next generation of the telescopes that cover the whole band.
Yeah. I'm very excited to see the many observatories around the world all looking for the same thing. That'd be very cool. I know with like exoplanets and, well, like with Hubble, say, you can look at historical data and make new discoveries. Is there a similar thing in exoplanetary studies?
The thing is, there's always more to be mined from data. There's no question that that's a great comet. But then we're also here, a selection effect, I mean, most of us here, we're looking for a phenomena that's below our current threshold. And so we have to go to the next thing.
That's cool. Emmanuel, in your area, do you have this kind of issue, or do you just add another laser?
Well, certainly we are certainly from the funding side, we're more on the small scale side of things. But certainly, I mean, actually there are, you know, if I even think of atomic physics experiments dealing with questions trying to address beyond standard model questions, for example, there are my colleagues at Harvard and Yale, for example, who are working on the EDM measurements, which are providing constraints on beyond standard model physics in a completely different way. And I think, you know, those are maybe small scale experiments. I mean, compared, you know, to LHC, I mean, these are still complex experiments on atomic physics scale and ingenious experiments. But, you know, maybe we're going to see more of those actually trying to probe beyond standard model physics in completely different ways. I mean, that's not going to replace any need for, you know, an ILC or something that can do precision physics, but it's going to maybe give us completely different ways of probing this physics. And I think people should be more open to that, to those kind of experiments too. I mean, they're having a hard time getting seen and getting, you know, funded, and even though it's just a tiny, tiny fraction, but there's just sometimes when you have one big thing, you don't see a lot of the beautiful small things that are also there. So maybe that's also worth exploring more.
Yeah, I fully agree with you that actually these small-scale experiments like EDM experiments are really reaching precision that are really amazing. We never reached such precision. And because of this precision can really unveil new physics. And there are really plenty of theory scenarios that can be better probed at this type of experiments than at large experiments like the LHC. So for this reason, I think it's really, really important, in my opinion, to keep a broad approach to particle physics, both from the point of view of the large experiments and these smaller experiments that can really tell us a lot. And then also, yeah, I wanted to add that in terms of analyzing data of the LHC, actually, so a lot of work, even of theorists, is going in the direction of really trying to really maximize what we learn from data of the LHC. Because if you want, you know, it can be that experimentalists first do not find new physics, do not find any compelling sign on new physics, but then it's really a collaboration, if you want, of experimentalists and theorists to really try to get the best out of data and to even think about new analysis of data and new strategies to analyze data to unveil eventually new physics. So.
I love those discoveries when you realize it's historical data. So a theorist came up with an idea and went, oh, we've actually been measuring this for so long. Look back at the data and there's a signal. And it's
right.
That's a wonderful discovery to make. Who's next?
I just want to comment on what Stefania just said, that it has happened recently that people looking through the CMB data and find Lansing B mode, which has been there all the time. And the LHC has taken so much data. And what if there is a new signal that it's just never pointed out that it needs to be analyzed that way, or it's never triggered any trigger, then it's just lost. Like, how do we?
Yeah, I think this is a very, very important question. So actually, part of my work goes really in this direction of trying really to not leave any stone unturned, if you want. So really to try to maximize what we learn from data. So the first problem that we are facing is indeed that, as I said before, we are not really keeping all data that we are producing. So we have the trigger. And then part of data is actually getting lost. So there is a lot of discussion, actually, between experimentalists and theorists in how to build, you know, the best trigger based on, you know, the theories that you want to see at the LHC, first of all. And then even beyond trigger, so trigger, in my opinion, is sort of the first step that you have to take care of when you think about, you know, looking for something at LHC. Then there is the question of the analysis. And then also for the question of the analysis, is really a big effort of both experimentalists and theorists in coming up with newer and newer analysis to perform at LHC of data. Because it's true that if you want, you know, it's really important to try every route possible to find new physics, because it's not really simple in the sense that LHC is a pretty, if you want, dirty environment, in the sense that we have really a lot of background. So you have to be really, really careful in designing properly your analysis of data in such a way that your signal that is eventually there doesn't get lost.
That's interesting. Where are we? Up here? Oh, right at the back.
So sort of following up on that, most of the conversation here has focused on experimental efforts, and as someone with a background in experimental physics, I really appreciate that. But I also wonder if this question of what to do if you don't get the next big thing points to a need to redirect or differently prioritize efforts on the theoretical side toward looking to identify phenomena that would be more amenable to investigation through these smaller scale things. Since we are at an Institute for Theoretical Physics, I wonder if we should maybe push something onto the theorists a little.
Yeah, that's right. I think, as I mentioned at the beginning, one of very big important questions that I have, that we do have as particle physicists, is really to define guiding principles. Because if you know, in the last few decades, we really learned a lot about particle physics. And the question is, are we in the right track, right? And in the past, probably, you know, the most studied theoretical framework has been supersymmetry. Now the question is still supersymmetry, the theory we want to study? Are there out there other theories that can be probed at the LHC, at smaller scale experiments? How to probe these additional theories that have not been probed up to now? And of course, as I view the field is pretty much triggered by experiments. So of course, we have to see in the coming years what experiments will be running and what type of data we'll have access to. And then also the theories that we can probe, we can focus on those theories that we can probe. Of course, we'll have really open questions, and my opinion is very, very important to keep an eye on these questions. The point is how the theories that are addressing these questions can be probed at the present and future high energy machines.
If I might add something to that, I am. So it's been a while since I was at a meeting where I started thinking about things like firewalls and quantum information loss and such things. But one of the things that I think is really interesting at the moment in terms of gravitational physics is just ask the questions related to quantum gravity, the big and the small. On Sunday, in one of the discussion roundtables that we had, I think it might have been Neil who suggested that perhaps there's this breakdown in effective field theory, that the fact that the cosmological expansion is related to something so large, but yet it's also related to something so small. And I think being guided by just exploring all the ideas that are at those edges that then help us to ask the right questions with the data is the key. So we need to have people brainstorming crazy things like firewalls. But then bringing them back and trying to figure out what the implication is if we with the data sets that we have access to. What can we do with those and how can we bring them together?
That's cool.
In 1950, when Schrödinger said that a scientific researcher should never lose sight of the role your particular subject has within the great performance of the tragic comedy of human life, I was wondering whether you feel that your subjects are still connected to kind of that sense of human life. Do you ever worry that they're disconnected? It's easy for medical researchers to make those connections, but obviously in physics, you know, we go a long way away from people's everyday concerns. So do you have any sense that you can connect to human concerns? And do you think this is an important thing for you still to be able to do?
Who wants to go first on that one?
Well, I mean, if you think the things I've talked about may sound abstract, but a lot of the application side I mentioned, I mean, we make use of every day. I mean, every day you turn on your mobile phone and rely on a GPS system to function, you're relying on some atomic clock flying in space. And people forget that, right? And they forget that. And also in terms of quantum materials, material science, condensed matter physics, I mean, that has given a tremendous revolution to our world. I mean, and who would have thought at that time, you know, would you have asked the same question? I mean, when people were investigating semiconductors for the first time, what kind of applications you're going to see for the man? Are you connected to mankind? Probably they would have said, no, I don't know anything, you know. When Arthur Schorlo, I just remembered Ted Hensch told me the story about Arthur Schorlo in Stanford when he invented the laser, right? He didn't know what to do with the thing. It just is, this is a sign of a solution that's looking for a problem, right? That's what he said. And look where these things are now. So I think it's really, when you do fundamental science, I think these questions are very hard, you know, to answer. But I think what we can say in hindsight, investments in fundamental science have been the most valuable investments coming, thinking of a venture capital perspective of society as a venture capitalist, you know, just trying to see fund and brainstorm crazy ideas, and if you are going to make it out there, that's certainly been a tremendous investment. I mean, our society, I think, absolutely forgets that.
Before we move on, Manuel, you got a taxi to catch.
All right.
You
got to go. Thanks.
Round of applause.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
Okay, who wants to pick it up?
I mean, that is certainly tough, because for most people, it's true. They have their daily grind. They wonder why we're spending so much money on science, although right. To the individual, it doesn't seem like that much that flows to us. And so actually, it's quite a challenge to keep convincing the world that we do need to invest in fundamental science. Now, for exoplanets, we've seen that we actually also have a very practical approach, because we train and inspire the next generation to go into technology. And many of the people that I interact with and teach, they go on to do engineering-related things in industry and et cetera. But we saw something else, actually, with exoplanets, and that's sort of this sort of sense of hope, that sometimes people want something apart from the daily grind and the depressing news and the overpopulation and all everything else. And so they like to be diverted for a while to know that there's just more out there. So I feel like we do have a lot to offer on many levels. He doesn't look convinced. But
oh, no. I'll convince him. We do have time as well. Yeah. Uh-huh. Do you want to add to like the human connection with
your
research?
Yeah, I agree with you, Sarah. That I mean, it's harder. You know, I cannot tell you, of course, what type of result we'll have from the discovery of the Higgs boson, or if you know, humans will be able to use the Higgs boson in the future for some technology. This I can of course not tell you, but the point is that, of course, as Sarah said, investigating fundamental physics can have always in the future some impact on our lives and the technology. And then, I want also to emphasize, as Sarah said, that actually the machine, the experiments that we are running in particle physics are really technologically cutting edge, and we are really developing technologies, and these technologies can really be used for everyday life, if you want, more concretely.
So I'm going to resist the comment on technologies and impact. I'm always reminded when I sort of talk to young kids, say 9-year-olds, and they're really curious. They want to know how the world works and why it works. And I can talk to them about gravitational waves, and I'm kind of surprised with some of the questions. They ask curious, really interesting things. I think society actually underneath it, even though we get buried under that daily grind, I think almost everybody still has that curiosity and values what we learn. It's hard sometimes because it does get buried under the deficit, but right. You know, I think we still need to do it, and I think we would, perhaps not at the same scale, even if the money wasn't available.
Yeah, because I often find being in science communication is there's a lot of onus put on the scientists to justify their existence in a human format, and I find that's a little bit unfair in a lot of ways, because you guys do what you do because you do it very well, and you get funding to do that. I think it's up to us, Michael. We need to communicate the science better and actually make it more human. So I think there needs to be more collaboration between, say, the media and science. You need more specialists. One thing I've always found, one of my biggest challenges in being a producer, is that I've got a lot of writers who are very, very good at what they do. But it takes a lot of work to find those writers who are very, very good at what they do. But once you find them and they make those connections and they're able to communicate an article in a very succinct way, it really builds enthusiasm for that science. And it provides an inspiration, because people wake up in the morning, you care about your job, you care about your breakfast, you care about the day to day. And most people, that's the same. You know, you have an office job, you just do what you do, you care about your family, you love your life, and you just do what you do. And really on the periphery is this amazing area of scientific research that probably you don't have a lot of time to read about. You may well read it online or get, you know, New Scientist or one of the other papers that you would have some interest in. But I think it's finding that news hook and that humanizing news hook within your areas that's key. And I think that only comes from a good collaboration with communication departments within your institutions and also with the science media. And also tabloid press. I mean, that's where most of the readership comes from. And it's wonderful when you see a well-written article in the tabloid press. Doesn't happen very often, but it's great when you see it. And if there's one thing tabloid press isn't very good at with exoplanets, is making that connection with aliens and exoplanets. And I'm not actually surprised we haven't had any questions on aliens yet. So. But feel free if you've got any questions about aliens. I mean, what am I saying?
If I can just make a comment, I need no convincing whatsoever that fundamental physics is worth exploring. The way I often see it is I sort of feel that I wouldn't want to be part of a society that wasn't asking questions like these. I think, you know, we would actually not realize how much we miss by being part of a society that abandons these kinds of questions.
It's very cool.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you all, having participated in Convergence, what do you feel was the value of bringing many different fields of physics together to learn about each other? And secondly, what would you like to see in the next Convergence?
I can start on this.
It's all on you guys.
Thanks.
Perfect. So I have to say that this Convergence conference was really, really great meeting. I really enjoyed it pretty much, and I really appreciated this opportunity to be part of such a, you know, big meeting with people coming from very different fields, and to have a lot of brainstorming with people. And actually, I think this is really a good way to go for the future, because I think in an environment like this, you can really come up with good ideas, good new ideas, and if you have young people around, it's very good for this. So I really, really enjoyed a lot of this first meeting, and I really hope that there will be a new meeting at Perimeter of this sort.
I think it was great to see people both struggling and very optimistic at the frontiers of what they're doing, and just to see so much commonality in sort of the theoretical and experimental pursuits across so many fields. It'd be great to see more provocative discussions and button pushing by Neil and others.
Yeah, for me, it's actually the diversity of both the topics and the people that actually really makes it a unique type of conference. And I value these times very, very highly to get to something like this where it's not my daily grind again. So I think it's very worthwhile to have this type of meeting and to provoke deeper questions of what it is we might do. I think the roundtable discussion with the list of questions that might be the most important ones, that was very good. I was very pleased with how that went. And I got lots of thoughts and provocative ideas, and it's really excellent.
Very cool.
Okay. I have a question not related to Neil's question about small-scale experiments. When I first heard about being able to determine some standard model parameters using parity violation in atomic transitions, I was really shocked that you can do a lab experiment and get parameters which are measured in LHC or other accelerators. So I have some friends working on it. So we often discuss how far one can go. For example, recently you have seen Higgs boson and you have seen its mass. So is there a way of pushing atomic transitions or some related things, like the way Emmanuel was telling about electric dipole moments and so on, to see Higgs particle, Higgs mass effect? Can one push to that?
So you're thinking about having smaller scale experiments that are probing the Higgs boson, for example, we have newly discovered. So that's kind of hard. So this goes quite a bit in the direction of what you want really to achieve with your experiment. So if your question is, the Higgs is interacting as far as we know, with all the massive elementary particles of the standard model. It's an open question, neutrinos, but okay, let's put them aside for a moment. And so you can think about designing and having a smaller scale experiment, probing the Higgs indirectly if you want. Because your aim can be not to produce the Higgs, so what we are doing at LHC is to produce the Higgs and look at the product of decay. But another way to look indirectly for the Higgs is to look at, indeed, how the Higgs is interacting with the other particles and measure the properties of the Higgs, even if we are not producing that directly. So in this respect, I think smaller scale experiments can really tell us a lot. Even, we mentioned EDM experiments, and in principle, you can think about having Higgs that have some couplings that are CP violating, and even these experiments could give us some information about the Higgs boson. So in my opinion, also, smaller scale experiments are really important to probe this new particle. Of course, it's a kind of a different way of probing it, because it's not really a direct way of probing this particle. And for probing this particle directly, you really need some kind of large-scale experiment. It can be the LHC now. In the future, it can be higher energy experiments or also ILC. But you really need to have a large amount of energy.
That's very cool.
So maybe, again, putting an organizer hat here. One of the goals of the conference was to inspire the young generation. And Sarah had this great story in her talk where an advisor told her, look, there is this planets that are coming out. It's a cool idea. Why don't you go check it out? So maybe as a representative of your own fields, what would be your reaction of a young student coming and saying, what should I check out?
Yep. Was I waiting for an answer, or I just realized I might have
jumped in?
Let me jump in and try some stuff. Look, I think gravitational wave astronomy actually is kind of a lucky field in this way right now, because it's not quite as clear. We don't actually have data in the same example where we have the discovery in front of us yet, but we hope it's coming very, very soon. So. One of the things that I try to encourage the graduate students that I interact with, and postdocs also, is to be ready for these first few detections, because they are going to actually be the ones that actually are, hey, look, there's this cool, interesting thing, and to be ready to have the tools to have an idea of things you want to do, and then to follow it from there. So I think, and by the way, that's cross-cutting. I think that is an area where we will see a convergence of theory with the gravitational wave observations, but also with electromagnetic astronomy. And it's pulling all of that together that's going to be the powerful area. So it's not quite the same as the example Sarah gave, but I think right now there are great opportunities ahead for young people in gravitational waves.
Yeah, the example I gave, I didn't mention that it's quite risky, actually. I hadn't seen another example like that, you know, in the past or future of an advisor handing such a risky project to a student. I was my advisor's first student. but the advice I try to give, if asked about this, is I always think of like the investment pie, you know, a pie chart. Some of that pie, you want to do the bread and butter that's going to get you a publication that will hopefully eventually lead to the job. But some of that, and how big that slice is, depends on your personality, is really taking a risk on something. Something that excites you, that's super amazing, but you know there's some possibility it may not actually work out, because you have to try many new things before you can get that intuition of what new problem actually will go somewhere. Right. So aside from assigning a concrete problem, I'll just finish with giving you maybe the best advice I got kind of indirectly from my mentor as a postdoc. It was John Bacall. A lot of you knew him and worked with him. And what he impressed on the postdocs was, you know, if you have a great idea, and you can back it up with physics, so you can work out the physics and show that it's sound. And he always added this other part, which, if it could be detected sometime in your lifetime, then it's worth going for.
Wow.
Yeah, and yeah, for particle physics, I think this idea of having you know, smaller scale experiments really exciting for young people, because as we saw yesterday in the talk of Neil Wiener, for example, this field of having you know, beam dump experiments, for example, was really started by postdocs. So having you know, good ideas for new experiments and new measurements that you can do is of course kind of risky, but it's really, really important for young people, because you're very good idea can lead to an experiment. Now there are a lot of you know, experiments and a lot of measurements, for example, in beam dump experiments that can tell us really a lot for particle physics beyond the LHC. So I think it's really a great opportunity for young people.
Yeah, Patrick made a really good point about, you know, preparing for the discovery of gravitational waves. Of course, Stefania, you've already been there. You know, you've been looking for Higgs particles for so long, and suddenly we made the discovery in 2012.
Right.
How did your life change pre to post discovery? Because it must be pretty revolutionary. So Patrick can get excited by gravitational waves.
No, that's definitely right. I mean, so first of all, the night of the discovery of the Higgs boson was announced, we had a big party, and that was really one of the funniest nights. That was really exciting.
So a big hangover is the answer.
But okay, beyond the joke, actually, so being a theorist, the discovery of the Higgs boson, basically, I would say that changed everything, because now we really know at least a part of the mechanism for giving mass to particles. So to the massive elementary particles. And I think this is really an amazing result, because before that, of course, if you want, sociologically, a lot of people would have really bet on the Higgs boson, but we didn't know. And to have an experimental confirmation of the existence of this particle has been really amazing for me. And then, as I said, now, really theoretically, we cannot really forget anymore about this hierarchy problem, because we know that the Higgs is there, so we know that we have these two scales. So it's really important to think about that. Yeah. And then also we have a brand new particle. It's completely, I would even call it a new physics, because it's a new particle that is completely different from any particle that we have. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's really, really important to understand better and better its properties. Up to now, you know, you hear a lot that basically the Higgs we have discovered is the Higgs of the standard model. It is definitely resembling the Higgs of the standard model, but we have to keep in mind that what up to now we have actually measured and discovered is that this new particle coupled to gauge bosons. We don't know really much about, you know, how it talks to fermions. We have some evidence. So there is so much that we can gain in this direction, and so much more knowledge that will come in the next few years for the Higgs boson.
Cool. So post-discovery,
things get even more complicated. That's very cool. Couple more questions, I think.
I've also really enjoyed the discussion and the challenges that people have been facing in their fields. And what was the quote? The excitement that we don't know a lot, which is great. But I also wonder that sometimes we can get a bit entrenched in our own camps. And I was just thinking what the panel and maybe the audience feel about having a discussion, I'll just use as an example, say on theories of the early universe, where we are assigned the side of the person who we disagree with. And we have to debate from their perspective. And I wonder if that would make us see things differently, because it's very easy to dismiss arguments by someone that you disagree with in physics, because you disagree with them, of course. But then it doesn't allow us the chance to see the potentially valid points that they may have. So I don't know what you think about that.
So you really need two counterpoints, wouldn't you? So really,
Well, information loss is a great example, right? You could make me defend firewalls and somebody else then do something else. I mean, actually, I find that a kind of a fun idea. I don't know how well it would work, but you know, it'd be a good experiment to carry out at the next meeting. I'm actually going to take this opportunity to jump in on the information loss side, because I was sitting here just remembering that it's 41 years since Hawking published his paper, right? And before that, then we had the laws of black hole mechanics a couple of years beforehand. And I must admit that it remains still one of my most intriguing sort of questions, and also it's amazing how much it draws people onto it. And I wanted to flag, I don't know if Jim is still in the audience, but Jim Bardeen made a comment during during John Preskill's talk about the basically dynamics of collapse and putting right now quantum mechanics on the fixed backgrounds of black hole spacetimes. And to me, I want to throw it out to the audience and as a question. I mean, to me, a big challenge, by the way, for quantum gravity and going forward is to understand just how that dynamics can be described in a more effective field theory approach. I think we've kind of abandoned that for other pictures, and I think it's still worth probing. So unfortunately, I'm actually taking the side I actually believe in rather than the opposite side, but there you go.
So in like an exoplanet studies, what points could you have to disagree with, I wonder? I mean, it's about the pros and cons of a habitable planet, or how to perhaps detect them?
Well, the one disagreement I think that's still relatively strong is how do giant planets form? And there are sort of two opposing theories. And one is, do they form from the bottom up, that small objects coalesce and then the planet has gravitational pull and exhausts the supply of material around it, or does it form from gravitational instability? And for a long time, this raged because your protoplanetary disk had to be just perfect in its corner of parameter space in order to have this instability occur, but probably both of them form.
Right.
So we don't have too many major controversies. We have little things that kind of come and go, like what is a habitable planet? You know, what makes the planet habitable? Where is the habitable zone boundary? People are fighting over that now. Mm-hmm. But I think it may be more effective because our arguments are somewhat less fundamental.
Yeah. It can be hard to find those two differences of opinion sometimes. All right, we've got time for a couple more questions. I want to kind of close on a question.
Yes. I've got a suggestion for the next convergence meeting. First, let me give pass on some advice my father gave me, which has proved very invaluable. Never, ever believe anything Eddie ever tells you. Check and check again. And I have to say that saved me on several occasions. Now, I have the strong feeling that there's far too much acceptance of received wisdom. After all, it was Einstein doubting the existence of the ether, which set off a whole lot of things. And one of the things, I constantly am amazed at how readily people accept the story of inflation. And Neil has been heroically questioning that. And I think I would welcome, and I've been trying to back him up, not in the discussions, but over the dinner. I think serious thought should be given to questioning seriously accepted wisdoms. I sent in a question, which was, what exactly does
inflationary theory presuppose, and what does it actually get out that it hasn't put in by hand? And there's been, that Neil has raised this question, and so have I over dinner. But I'm just absolutely staggered at the ignorance of the history of inflation, people who will say that the baryon acoustic oscillations were worked out in the framework of inflation theory, when in fact it was done in the 1970s, I think, by Jim Peebles, without any notion of inflation at that stage. And these things just float around as if it was gospel truth. I think there should be much more questioning of these received wisdoms.
That's true. And I suppose with inflationary theory, of course, when I was in university, that was the accepted truth. And it doesn't really come with any, well, you know, it does come with some evidence, but of course there are other interpretations. I think that was in Kendrick's presentation yesterday, I suddenly realized just how many models there were of inflation. And I don't know, I mean, do you have any opinions on that, about accepting theories as fact and then building your own research on them? Is there a danger there in your fields, do you think?
Well, I just want to say, great idea. I love that idea for the theme of a meeting, just challenging accepted truths. I just want to finish up with that example I gave where the two communities of planet formation were fighting. It's most likely that in this particular case, unlike in the case for inflation, but in this particular case, both mechanisms probably work. Because we just, well, we just got more data and we have these giant planets so far from the star, that's probably only one way they can form another one. So,
so you just agree to disagree.
Well, the thing is, they fought for so long and the established truth was the one that always won the argument.
Yeah.
And so actually, in fact, I think it's a great idea for next time.
That'd be fun. All right, one more question, I think, and then I'm going to probably begin to close. Any more comments or questions? No more microphones being passed out? Oh, one more.
I have a question just to follow up that last one, because I think very often the public perception, especially of theoretical physics, is that it's just people sitting around thinking up crazy ideas and challenging the past. And like all of us, I'm sure, get many, many emails from crackpot folks who have some idea overturning Einstein. And this is kind of, as much as I love the idea of within the field of physics, of kind of questioning received wisdom, I'm just curious how we can deal with this as a perception, you know, public perception of physics. Because so many people just think, oh, physicists are just like lone geniuses sitting in their, you know, their offices thinking about philosophy, and not thinking about, you know, past experimental evidence, past, you know, theories that do work and do explain the universe quite well.
Yeah, I think it'd be cool. Okay, so I just wanted to ask one final question, really, of all our panelists. Unfortunately, Emmanuel's not here, but Patrick, when you wake up in the morning, what is the one thing that you dream is going to happen in your field that you're very excited for? And obviously, the discovery of gravitational waves is kind of obvious. But is that the thing that really drives you? Is it that discovery? And in which case, what are you going to do after? Because
fair question and well ended. So for me, I actually quite often say that I'm looking forward to the second one, because the truth is that there's two big things in our field. One is that we've been 100 years waiting, right, for this. And so this is a huge individual discovery with its own stresses and other things on it. So when I wake up in the morning, I do worry that we've got all of the T's crossed, I's dotted, and things are under control. But what I look forward to is actually not that first measurement, but actually the ones that come after it, and the few tens that come in that first few years. I think that we have this bread and butter source that we think of being pairs of black holes or neutron stars crashing into each other, and the signal being so clear and clean for what it's going to be. But I guess also my hope is that we'll still end up with these curiosities about what it is we find. And we'll only see that after we start to get a few of these things. It's not going to be there in the very first one, most likely. Right.
It's very cool. Very cool field. Stefania, you've discovered the Higgs. You're getting up close and personal with the Higgs now. When you wake up in the morning, what is the one thing now you want to discover or find out about your particular field?
Yeah, so I think in terms of discoveries, I think it would be really, really exciting to learn more about what dark matter is. Mm. So, you know, in the future, thinking about discovering a new particle that can be dark matter and understanding more about dark matter, I think this would be really an amazing goal for particle physics. So, of course, being a particle physicist, the aim is to discover new particles, but even without, I think it's a very big result also not to discover new particles, in the sense that what we have learned with the null discoveries of the LHC or smaller scale experiments is really a lot for particle physics. Mm-hmm. Of course, the best would be to discover really a plethora of new particles. Interesting new particles can be dark matter, can be some new particle belonging to the dark sector, as we heard yesterday. But also the not discovery, I think, adds really a lot to our knowledge.
Right. I'm looking forward to seeing that signal. We don't know what it is, and then you guys have got to try and figure it out. So Sarah, obviously looking for a habitable world, is looking for a true Earth-like planet the thing that gets you most excited in the morning, or is it something broader?
Well, you know, speaking of the mundane and everything, when you want these big things to happen, actually, it turns out it's less physics and engineering and more politics, unfortunately.
Right.
So that's what I want to happen. It's not my favorite part of the day, actually. And so still like everyone here, my favorite thing is thinking about whatever newest, most exciting problem that I have in my sphere to work on. Mm-hmm. And that's what gets me up in the morning.
Right. But you got to deal with the politics as well and the funding.
Yeah.
But I just want to thank all my panelists, and thanks to Patrick, Stefania, and of course Sarah, and of course Emmanuel, who had to leave early. That was very insightful, and thank you everybody for an amazing conference. It was enlightening, and I'm certainly going to have plenty to write about when I get back home. But yeah, just keep wondering about nature and the universe, and I'm very excited that we had this amazing convergence gathering, and thank you to the organizers for a great event. So thank you, and have a safe journey home wherever you live.
So thank you, Ian, and the panel. So ladies and gentlemen, this finish and concludes the Convergence Conference here at the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics in Waterloo, Ontario. To everyone and to everyone that joined online over the past few days, thank you for making this a very enjoyable meeting. And on behalf of Neil Turok and myself, as the co-organizers of this event, we would also like to extend our sincere thanks to all of Perimeter staff who worked so hard to make this event such a success. Safe travels.